This is KOOP HD1 HD3 Hornsby. Welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs, the state of your civil liberties in the Lone Star State. The views expressed here are not necessarily those of the co-op board of directors, staff, volunteers, or underwriters. The following was homecrafted and recorded on April 21st. Thanks for the handoff, Rocky. On April 4th, the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, issued its latest report. The good news is that renewable energy sources are now economically viable, with the price still decreasing. Nevertheless, political will is lagging, and inertia of the status quo is formidable. CNN quoted Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who called the report a litany of broken promises and a file of shame, cataloging the empty pledges that put us firmly on track towards an unlivable world. Guterres concluded, "The jury has reached a verdict, and it is damning. We are on a fast track to climate disaster." As we record this episode, tomorrow, April 22nd, is Earth Day 2022. The theme this year is Invest in Our Planet. From the website earthday.org, climate and environmental literacy, coupled with strong civic education, will create jobs, build a greener consumer market, and allow citizens to engage with their governments in a meaningful way to address the climate crisis. The world and its people are facing full-scale emergencies across multiple fronts, from climate change to the loss of animal and plant species. In order to make the best choices in their daily lives and catalyze the urgent change needed, people everywhere need to be properly educated. That starts in school. Governments have recognized this for decades, and many have introduced some level of climate and environmental education into their education systems. But the truth is that the quality, consistency, frequency, honesty and impact of climate and environmental education is in some cases weak, cursory, and still in all too many countries, non-existent. There remains a huge cavernous gulf between what governments and education systems say they are doing and the reality on the ground for the vast majority, if not all, school-aged children in rich and poor countries alike. Good evening and welcome to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. Our guests are from the Austin hub of the Sunrise Movement and include Jordan Middlebrooks, Kristen Herring, and Annie Fierro. The Sunrise Movement is a youth movement to stop climate change and create millions of good jobs in the process. It's building an army of young people to make climate change an urgent priority across America, to end the corrupting influence of fossil fuel executives on politics, and to elect leaders who stand up for the health and well-being of all people. Michelle Manning Scott, associate producer of the show, is also with us. Welcome, Jordan, Kristen, and Annie. How are you doing today?
Hey.
Hey, good. Thank you for having us. Sorry, I got kids in the background.
Very authentic. Thank you for that. Why don't each of you tell us a little about yourselves?
Okay, I'm going to say let's have Annie go since she's our hub leader.
Yeah, okay. So my name is Annie Farrow, and I would be considered the political lead coordinator, but lately I've been falling under the category of our hub coordinator, which I'm very against having hierarchies within social justice movement, because I feel from a very long time we have led patriarchy and social oppression and all of those things to remind us that just one person has the power and just one person is carrying the torch. Well, that's not true, because all of us have torches and all of us have ideas that probably I haven't even thought about. So I try to avoid putting that label on myself, although sometimes because of how our society works, you have to say those things to make sure that you're standing out. But mostly what I focus on my work, it's being the political lead. And basically what that entails is just working primarily around our government, policy, and politics. And that work ranges from election cycles. And the last time I was here, it was around the 2020 election. And also from that to the multiple long sessions that we just had of the Texas legislation, and as well helping draft policy implementations that we would like to see that truly embody what we envision as a Green New Deal. And we work on policy either with our city, with the county, or statewide. It's a little harder to get something going with their state. So that's why elections are important. But before I jump into more things of more of that election cycle and what we do and what we are not doing right now, I'm going to give it to the other hub members to introduce themselves.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Kristen Herring. I have been volunteering with Sunrise for about 8 months now. And I got involved because of Instagram. I saw that they were having an event to show Indigenous solidarity. And it was about the pipelines. And I was just like, you know, I really want to be more active in my community, especially if people are going to be showing solidarity with Indigenous people, since I am also Indigenous. So I went out there and it was a really nice rally. People really understood it. There was a lot of Indigenous people there too. And literally Jordan here was the one who was like, if any Indigenous person at this event would like to speak and share anything at all, like, please, you're like, here you go. And she literally held space for us. And that was the moment I was like, yes, I'm going to join Sunrise. This is a great organization. They get it. And they literally are holding space for us. That's never happened to me before. So I was like, all right, I'm in. But I've been doing a lot of other work here in the city. I was with Austin Now, which stands for National Organization for Women. And lately I've been focusing more on reproductive care, especially after SB 8 was passed last year. But even more so because a few years ago, I had to use abortion care on an unhealthy pregnancy here in Texas. Yeah, it was a very traumatic experience. I almost, my life was at risk and the people here did not want to help me. And I was just like, okay, after I survived that, I was like, I'm definitely going to be more part of this community. And joining Sunrise, they've completely, even though our focus is more on climate change, they understand the intersectionality that climate change does have a direct correlation with reproductive justice. So that's why I'm here. That's why I'm with Sunrise.
And we're glad you could join us today. And I'm guessing that Sunrise is very glad to have you too. Let's go on to Jordan.
Yes, we definitely are glad to have Kristen. My name is Jordan Middlebrooks. I would consider myself an organizer within the Sunrise Movement Austin Hub. I do kind of a mix of a lot of different things. I've done a lot of hub coordination and what we call base building, which is basically reaching out to new members, getting them plugged in, administrative type things, I'm running our finances at the moment. And I also have in the past led a lot of our actions and helped plan and coordinate those, even though it's really a shared effort. You might notice we are not a very hierarchical organization, so we tend to share a lot of responsibilities. But I got involved with the movement back in 2020. I feel like my whole life, I've really just been looking for a way to create like actionable impact centered around climate justice. And it took me a long time of kind of bopping around through a lot of different groups to find one that I really aligned with. And that also allowed me to really live by my values. So that's kind of one of the things that I love about this movement. And we're excited to be here with you, Bob. So thanks for having us.
Well, thank you for joining us. Each of you, I think, has mentioned the term hub, and the Sunrise Movement is broken into local chapters, and they're called hubs. A little later in the show, we'll talk about specific activities for the Austin Hub. Could one of you describe the overall movement? Tell us about its history and its mission, who are members of it, and so forth.
I can definitely speak to that. So Sunrise, the general movement, or what we sometimes refer to as like the national organization, it really came about around like 2016, 2017, as we've all experienced big oil and really a lot of the organizations that power like hyper-capitalism, big pharma, big medicine, all of those have a huge sway in government and policy and really contribute to the repercussions of what we're living in day to day. And so the Sunrise Movement came about being a youth-led movement because we all have to live through these choices and we don't even have a real voice or a real say necessarily in the politics and what's happening across the country. So I would say 2018 is probably where it took off the most. There was a sit-in at Nancy Pelosi's office. And then it led to the collaboration with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, to create the first legislature around the Green New Deal, which is centered around climate justice and recognizes that in order to successfully achieve climate justice, it's not just stopping carbon emission, it's a whole just transition focused on creating green jobs, which can also be jobs like teaching, can be jobs like healthcare, can be jobs like art. The intersectionality with, like Kristen mentioned earlier, reproductive justice and all of these things, it's really focused on the intersectionality. So that was kind of the formation of the Sunrise Movement. And then from there, it's turned into a lot of electing candidates that can represent a Green New Deal and climate justice. We actually have a few candidates that we have supported just for this upcoming election in November. So you might have heard of Jessica Ciernos and Claudia Zapata. Those are two Sunrise Movement members who are running for a local election. So that's one aspect of it. And then the other is really focused on leading actions and leading campaigns to really make the Green New Deal a reality and build the type of future that we all deserve to live in.
It's a fairly young organization, but it sounds like it's really mushroomed, you know, with 400 hubs.
So I know the National Org has had a lot of upside downs because of how it was lacking representation from all groups. It might seem like with what we're doing here in Austin, it reflects the entire movement, but unfortunately, it has not most of the time. And that has led to a lot of loss in membership. Currently, there's a plan to relaunch the entire strategy because as much as we recognize the importance of having allies in the halls of Congress, we also understand that we need to talk to our people. And that's something that we haven't done that before. We go and door knock and ask them for their vote, but we never actually take the time to have an empathetic conversation and just ask like, how are you doing today? And stay there, listen. And those are the conversations that actually gonna get us to eventually take over DC or I don't know, something completely different, especially with the climate crisis and not having anything happening right now. We have federal legislation like the BBB was in DC advocating for that, but we had a Manchin in Sinema. And even though there were Democrats, Sunrise was advocating for Sinema a little bit at the beginning. They completely turned their backs once they got there because of corporate money. So that is making us realize how we need to focus on lighting everyone's torches and just making sure that it's not just them showing up to vote, but they know the context behind that. And right now we are trying to get new membership from all sides of the aisle. The national movement is also trying to do the same thing and trying to deviate a little bit from elections, not pushing that aside because it's important. We need that right now, but we haven't really touch base with people, and we're just giving it all the power to that one person who's going to hopefully win the election. I'm not so sure the number exactly, but that's where the national org is at the moment.
Sounds like you're rebuilding a little bit, at least at this point.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's talk a little about the mission. In preparing for the show, I was digging through some of the website for the Sunrise Movement. One of the areas that seems to be prominent is this sense of environmental justice. Could one of you define that and tell us a little about what it is and how things got into the state that they're in right now?
Yes, I can share. Okay, so this all started with colonization in 1492 when the Europeans came over and decided to invade and rape and pillage and take over this country, plagiarize the Iroquois Confederacy Constitution and redo everything under their image and use slave labor. And that's where it started from. Indigenous people, we've been taking care of these lands for hundreds of thousands of years. Environmental justice would be talking to us, seeing what we know. We're still here. We still take care of our land, especially those who are still living on their ancestral lands are still taking care of her. Environmental justice would be talking to your local community and being like, okay, well, if y'all have been doing it for hundreds of thousands of years and obviously been doing it the right way, teach us. So that's why I'm here. I'm here to remind everybody that Indigenous people, Native Americans, we're still here. We actually know what we're doing. We've been knowing what we're doing, and we would like to be part of the conversation. And more importantly, we would like to teach y'all how to take care of Mother Earth.
So over the years, it seems like poor people and often people of color have been subject to some of the worst of environmental impacts. For example, you don't find landfills over in West Austin, or you don't find dirty industrial plants there. I suspect that that's no accident, right?
Nope, it's not. Right. It's done on purpose.
Right.
When we talk about in Indigenous communities, when we talk about MMIW, which stands for Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women, we talk about the man camps. Why are the man camps so close to the reservations? 90% of the rapes and murders that are happening to Indigenous women are from those men who are working to destroy our planet, and they're being housed right next to us. This has never been anything except on purpose.
Calling attention to this, it seems to me, is the first step. Does the Sunrise Movement have a strategy for dealing with all this?
Most definitely. So I grew up near Chicago, and I had a very different education than a lot of my friends that have lived here in Texas. And I've noticed that even though I did not have the best education up near Chicago, this is a huge issue in Texas, especially here in Texas. The indoctrination is real here. People don't know what they don't know. And when people think or are being taught in their school, in their textbooks, that Indigenous people, we gladly handed our land over. It was just like, people really have a completely different idea and experience growing up in this country, especially here in Texas. A lot of people don't understand colonization. the first job I had while living here in Texas, I literally had my boss thank me and another Indigenous woman for, quote unquote, giving her ancestors our land. And like, she honestly thought that that was appropriate to say. And me and the other Indigenous woman, we just looked at each other like too, you know, dumb to speak. It was like, it was crazy. So the focus right now is education, educating ourselves, educating our peers, educating people that are in the Sunrise Movement so that we can all be on the same page and educate and lead together. And then also create teach-ins for the public because nobody's being taught anything here. I mean, it's definitely everywhere. Like I had a history book that was thousands of pages and there's only one chapter that talked about the thousands of tribes that lived here pre-colonization. So it's definitely, it's not just a Texas thing. It's definitely an American, if not North American thing, to pretend that colonization was for survival. They don't want to teach the truth. And so that's why you see this huge culture war with white people being like, but you gave us your land. I don't understand why you're mad at me. And then Black Indigenous people of color being like, you tried to exterminate us. Of course I'm angry. You know what I mean? So it definitely starts with education.
Yeah, and just to add on to what Kristen was mentioning, a lot of the type of policy that we're advocating for, you know, a component of the Green New Deal is supporting the land back movement and being able to make Indigenous people the stewards of their land. And so that's another component of, you know, I would say the broader strategy. And when we talk about a Green New Deal, racial justice is the foundation of a Green New Deal and the policy and actions that we're trying to lead. And when policy fails, a lot of the work we do also comes into mutual aid. So how can we support these groups that are not being supported, like all of the action that's happened around the homeless camps that have now been set up and moved away? You know, majority of those are Black Indigenous people of color. And like with the jet fuel tank, that's happening in East Austin, where there's more communities of color. So we're kind of seeing it across the board and recognize that racial justice is absolutely necessary if we're going to really do anything about climate justice.
You mentioned the jet fuel farm at the Austin airport, and we actually covered that about 2 weeks ago on the show. It strikes me that even on the part of the city of Austin, there seems to be a lot of goodwill and organizing around sustainability. People that are leaders are aware of the big picture here and what needs to happen. And yet, you know, when push comes to shove, all of a sudden we've got more people wanting to fly than ever before. What happens? The city immediately jumps on a solution of increasing fossil fuel consumption and placing this terminal in a neighborhood that's, again, far from West Austin, it seems to me. I don't know about you guys, but I get really discouraged by stories like this.
It is really disheartening. And it just kind of shows that these racial disparities, it's not something in the past. It's happening in our everyday lives. And it's also our responsibility, especially as I have a lot of privilege being a white person. It's also our privilege to be able to support the demands of those people that are being impacted by those harmful things like the jet fuel tank.
The same thing seems to be going on globally right now with this war in Ukraine. This is clearly disrupting the flow of petroleum. And again, it would seem to me that at a crisis time like this would be the moment to kind of pounce and start looking at alternatives seriously. But boy, I don't see that happening. And in terms of strategies, it seems like a golden opportunity.
Yes, absolutely. I feel like that's why we're starting to take more action now than ever. And we want to start educating people, especially actual youth, because we're not as young as a lot of other folks in our state. And none of the action has been taken. Like, we know that big fossil fuel companies like Exxon, Shell, they knew this was happening since 1986. That was the first time Shell knew that we were approaching catastrophe. And they decided to push it aside completely because there wasn't any profit. Or there was, but not right now. And right now they could just keep adding more and more money. And so they pushed it completely aside, just like Exxon did. Exxon at the beginning of the 90s had an entire group of environmentalists and scientists working to measure the emissions and how we were approaching that. And once they saw that, oh yeah, that's actually happening. And then we had the Clinton administration with Al Gore and the tax on carbon, they freaked out because there wasn't going to be as much money. So they completely erased that chapter. And today I found out that a lot of those records are publicly owned and at UT. So we can all learn about their research at Exxon for how long they have known that all of these things are happening and how on purpose, because of the tax on carbon during the Clinton administration and Al Gore talking about climate, how they pushed all that aside because they were going to get less money, even though they already have a lot more money that I'm ever going to see in my life, much less more Latinx folks like myself, indigenous folks, oh, people of color. So yeah, I wanted to highlight that aspect. And also with education piece that we were talking about, recently I've been invited to talk with schools. And this morning I spoke at the Galindo Elementary, and it was from pre-K to fifth grade. And last week I talked with Eco Rights, and it's a group of the Youth Council of San Antonio and Austin, and they collaborate with city council. They give ideas. Every single time I have talked at a school, I leave with the kids being inspired, but at the same time furious that they are not learning about any of these topics, that they have to take the class of the class of the class to get a guest speaker like myself or another environmental group or a racial justice group. I feel that's how we're pivoting our mission and strategy right now. How can we make that a priority and make sure that if they're angry, that we use that anger for good? Because according to the IPCC report, we have 3 years to completely change everything, because we haven't since early the 80s. And if we don't start acting now, it's going to be very devastating, especially to the eyes of systemic oppression and capitalism. You are not worth anything, as we have seen with where these plants are being placed and with historical redlining, and all of those issues keep continuing.
We need to take a short station break, but we'll be right back. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Civil Rights and Wrongs on Co-op 91.7 in Austin, streaming through koop.org. I'm your host, Bob Daly. This evening's show was homecrafted and recorded on April 21st. Our guests are from the Sunrise Movement and include Jordan Middlebrooks, Kristen Herring, and Annie Fierro. Let's pick up where we left off.
The industries have known what they're doing, and they've done it on purpose, and they are not even ashamed of it. They are like, yeah, we knew, but that we wanted money. We want money, just like we have a Joe Manchin right now.
Going back to what you were just mentioning, Bob, I think what's funny, not actually funny, haha, but we have had the solutions we need to mitigate the impacts from the IPCC report. And it's been a choice from our leaders, from the people at these very high corporate institutions. It's a choice that we're choosing to not invest in these. We've had many reports that have said the exact same thing. And so I think what can make someone feel hopeless is the fact that you don't directly have the power to make these changes happen. But that's actually not true, is that we do have the power. It is all of us coming together and contributing to these systems that make these continue to run. So, I mean, imagine if everyone went on strike one day, or if everyone refused to participate in the day-to-day operations of this country, I think we would see a ton of change happen because nothing would run. So we really do have the power when we come together and are able to see what each other need and support each other through that. But there's so many barriers in the way of getting there, but it is possible.
We can only hope. Locally, you've also been involved with an initiative regarding the Fayette Power Plant. Could you tell us a little about that?
Yeah, definitely. And Kristen and Annie are welcome to chime in as well about that, because it's really been a huge hub effort. I'm not sure how much your listeners or you, Bob, have heard about the Fayette Power Project. Essentially, this is a coal plant that is co-owned by Austin Energy and the LCRA. And there were previous agreements and negotiations to shut down the Austin Energy portion of the plant. And that decision was kind of negged back in November. And there wasn't really much information about what was going to happen with the plant and, you know, why this decision was made. Some pretty vague statements, both by the LCRA and Austin Energy. One of the main impacts of this plant is that, number one, it's directly harming the community. Coal ash is going into a reservoir, which is where the coal plant sits on top of, and people go into that reservoir. It's available for the public. It's also emitting coal emissions into the air, which is contributing to air pollution. So it is directly harming the community in that way, but it's also an area that does not have a union, which can lead to higher levels of exploitation in the workplace. And so in Austin, it's impossible for us to achieve the climate plans that the city has stated with this plant continuing its operation. So not only are we failing the community in LaGrange, which is where the Fayette Power Plant is, we're also failing the people of Austin because we are not going to be able to achieve climate equity or our climate plan in 2030, like the city of Austin has promised. So we've been working on a campaign to not necessarily just shut the plant down. That's not really, you know, the type of future that we're looking to create and build. We are looking to have a just transition from this plant, one that accounts for the needs of the workers and the community, because it is the main source of income for most of the community. And what that really means is figuring out and establishing an alternative so that these workers do not lose their job, do not lose their income, and the ability to care for their families. So we've been working on a campaign around that, mostly just on public awareness at this point. You've heard everyone mention education. That's right. A huge component. So we just had a teach-in a couple weeks ago, and now we're trying to do more around actually engaging the LaGrange community as well, because we don't want to impose our demands and expectations on them. We want to hear what they need in their community and support that.
Got it. And you're also involved with a protest in what's commonly known as Corpus Christi, but maybe Kristen, you could talk about this. It involves some Native peoples in the area. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, definitely. It's being led by a Karankawa woman. Her name is Kiara. She is an amazing person, very strong and powerful. She led the same protest last month. Recently, she led a march against Bank of America, and a little over 400 people who came all over Texas and even part of Nebraska, I believe, some people came down here and protested Bank of America's connections to these oil pipelines, which are destroying our planet as well as everybody that lives on her. So this weekend on Saturday, a bunch of us from Sunrise and a few other groups and, you know, a lot of the indigenous community is going down to support in solidarity and demand land back and no more pipelines. Kill the black snake. That's a very popular phrase in our community.
So it's focused on transport, petroleum transport then.
Yes, as well as acknowledging that the Karankawa are still here. They are still in existence. They deserve sovereignty and land back. And it's a little bit talking about decolonization as well, because when we talk about land back, we're talking about decolonization, which is going back to pre-colonization and taking care of Mother Earth the way that, you know, we've been doing for hundreds of thousands of years. Obviously, I'm not Karankawa, I'm Lumbee, but, you know, it's very important for me especially to show up in solidarity with them.
Kristen, I don't know if you want to mention any of the like history with Enbridge or the artifacts that have been found in the area.
So Enbridge is one of the companies that's leading these oil pipelines, not just here in Texas, but also up north and through Canada. Actually, Jordan, why don't you say a little bit?
So essentially what has happened is MODA, which is now Enbridge, has purchased the land that is really owned by the Karankawa people. And they have discovered artifacts in what is, you know, commonly called Corpus Christi. And this is land that Enbridge is planning to expand on. So not only are we not giving this land back to Karankawa people or protecting their history and the artifacts there, which are sacred, Enbridge is actually going to be putting oil and gas operations and infrastructure there, which will continue to harm that area. A lot of the action being done is really to fight back against that. Bank of America is one of the biggest lenders and funders for Enbridge, as well as Chase Bank. So some of the actions that Kristen was mentioning were targeting the people that are funding the pipeline. But Enbridge is also responsible for the Line 3 pipeline and the Line 3 pipeline expansion, which had a lot of global action around that as well.
That's right. They are wanting to put an oil pipeline through a Karankawa grave site where they bury their people. And of course, Enbridge doesn't care about that. It's not white people, so who cares, right? So they're like more than happy to continue these projects. And like what you were saying earlier, Bob, like it's not on accident. These people are being targeted on purpose because these companies know that the majority of Americans don't care about us, don't care about these people, and aren't going to make such a fuss about it.
Well, this has been most enlightening. As I listen to the three of you, it's obvious that you're all really invested in what you do. I'd like to hear from each of you what this has meant for you, this involvement, and how it has energized you, and what are your hopes for the future as a result of your activities? Whoever wants to start, go ahead.
This has been a very healing movement for me personally, joining Sunrise and just seeing the intersectionality and like what Annie was saying earlier about it not being a hierarchy. We all learn how to be leaders. It's just a very different vibe. And just being in this community is energizing. Knowing that I'm surrounded by people who are like-minded and want to educate themselves and actually put action to their words, that just in itself, being in community is energizing for me. But it's also been very healing because I've been given a lot of emotional support from Sunrise and the people that are part of the movement, and have made some pretty good friends within the activist community here. And overall, it's been a very healing experience. Growing up, I had a lot of anger issues. Gee, I wonder why, right? But I had a lot of anger. And it wasn't until I like kind of joined Sunrise that I was able to actually channel that anger into good energy. And yeah, just being in community with everybody and being able to, you know, like be given space to be myself and to express the Indigenous experience and not have people push back on me it's been very energizing and healing in that way.
How about you, Annie?
Yeah, I feel like in the same way as Kristen, I've always treasured community. And I feel like that's the first step that we need to have in order to achieve collective liberation, because we need to be there for each other. And even though we're going to lose some fights and win others, if we don't have someone to go to, if we don't have a group that is there for us, and we're constantly on learning, we're, even if we're not on the same page, we're willing, we have the willingness to adapt and to listen and to change. And we understand that as much as we talk, we also have to listen. And to me, that's one of the things that I've been missing in other organizing spaces. It seems like just one person is the one who says everything, or you have to apply to get to that position. That's not really what it stands for. It's supposed to be all of us talking about everything that we do, who we are, and just hearing that every day, especially through Sunrise, when you have 15-year-olds coming and telling you, oh no, that's not how it is. Let me tell you, that is so motivating and so empowering to hear. Because when I was 16, maybe I was aware of all of these issues and I've always liked to organize, but I was not like, oh, let me tell you. And that is just hopeful. And finally, that is not just a lot of white people leading the movement. It's like, because that's how it has been for the most part. And even when it has not been the case with like the feminist movement in the 70s, that it was primarily initiated and led by Black women, the attention went towards all the white women that were leading it, not really the ones that taught the white women. So that's what keeps me going, and the sense that I have friends, community, and that we are here for the long haul. And even if we don't win all the fights, we know we're there for each other and we're going to keep moving forward.
For myself, I think Kristen and Annie did a great job covering the community aspect of it. That's a huge part of it. For me, I get to do this with people that have the same values and interests as myself. But the other part of it is that I have known my whole life that I want to do something about all of the issues in the world, and that I don't want to just be on the sideline and remember that about my history when any children that I have, their grandchildren, you know, have to live through the real repercussions of climate change. And so for me, it's also living by my values and knowing that I get to influence the future that I have, and I get to influence the future that other people have. And it might not always reflect exactly what I want. It's a huge fight with a lot of burnout, but I get to help shape that. And that's so important to me, to be able to build the future that we all deserve to have. So I'm really grateful for it.
Michelle, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Well, it's been interesting to listen to all of you younger people talk. So, I mean, and it just reminds me how much I do have hope for younger generations to help us older generations move forward in the progress that needs to be made on this issue. And as I was just telling Bob earlier, you know, I've learned so much from being a part of this program and the number of people and different organizations that were involved in the discussions we've had here on civil rights and wrongs. And so I applaud all of you for all the actions you're taking, and I appreciate everything you guys are doing. It's great, inspiring.
Well, and I really want to thank all of you as well. This has been the most enlightening, and I certainly wish you the best in all of your efforts. The planet depends on the likes of each one of you and the noble effort that you're putting forth in this. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us. It's nice to be given space to share.
All right. Peace and all the best to you.
Bye. Thank you. You too. Bye.
Bye. Bye now.
More information about the Sunrise Movement can be found at www.sunrisemovement.org.
Well, it's Thursday, April 21st, and once again, we're speaking with Austin Sanders, staff writer for the Austin Chronicle. How you doing, Austin?
I'm doing all right. How are you, Bob?
Hey, just fine. I think a city council meeting just ended, didn't it?
Didn't end, but they're taking a break. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for working us in here. I noticed you've got 4 stories this week in the print issue.
Yeah, it was a busy week.
I bet it was. One of them deals with the city's land trust. Apparently, the city has some land and is actually using that to try to lure back people who were displaced. Have I got that right?
Yeah, more or less. So basically, what the city has done is they have been kind of buying up land across the city with intentions of building affordable housing on the land. And the model they're using are known as community land trusts. Basically, these are situations where governments or nonprofits own the land where a house is built, a home is built, and then the home itself is sold to individual buyers, right? So the owner owns the structure, but not the land. And this can help reduce the cost of home ownership, right? Especially in a growing city like Austin, where land is so valuable, right? We're talking, this can account for, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of the cost of a home, right? So this can be a significant savings for the potential owner. So that's part of what we're talking about here is this community land trust model, which is brand new to the city of Austin. Other cities across the country have deployed similar models to success. But the city is also pairing this land trust model with what the city calls housing preference policy. Other cities have something similar. Theirs are called right to return policies. And what these are designed to do, as you said, introducing the story, bring people back to the city who have been displaced due to gentrification pressures, right? Mainly in our case, this is going to be people who were living in East Austin and due to rising housing costs were forced to move further north, out of the city and into the suburbs altogether. So this housing preference policy is going to reserve some of these land trust homes for people who can prove connections to the city of Austin dating back to 2000, the year 2000. So people who they themselves or an immediate family member, like a parent, a grandparent, or a guardian, were displaced within the past 22 years, if they can prove that and they meet other requirements such as income thresholds, basically they can't make more than $63,000 a year for a joint income. That's about 80% of Austin's median family income. And some other requirements, there's an application process. They'll enter a lottery and then city staff will kind of randomly select people who will be allowed to purchase these homes, right? And then from there, it's kind of your typical home buying process. You apply for a mortgage, work with a lender, the city selects, has options you can choose from, and then you close, and then you have your housewarming party and you move in and you get a home at a much lower price than is going to be affordable at market rates, right? Like some of the numbers that I include in the story are a 2-bedroom home under this program will be sold for about $200,000, $220,000 or so. It'll kind of fluctuate. But March data from the Austin Board of Realtors shows that the median home in Austin sold for about $624,000, right? So we're talking significant savings that this land trust program will afford for families in Austin.
This sounds really good. I guess the main question I have regards scalability. I mean, is this a handful of houses, you think, or is there really hope that this could make a serious dent in the population that was displaced? What's your take?
Probably not. Yeah, it's much closer to a handful. Currently, the city has about 28 properties. Obviously, you know, they're continuing to seek more purchase opportunities, but they have about 28 properties that are going to be eligible for this program. The first is going to go through the lottery and selection process in June, and then the rest are going to happen later this year. But yeah, obviously 28 homes nowhere near the amount that the city needs to kind of combat the housing shortage. We're talking thousands, tens of thousands of units that are needed compared to 28. But this is a way, again, that the city can really target people who have really felt the pains directly of gentrification. You know, they or their family members were displaced as a result of gentrification to bring them back into the city. Though it should be noted, as I said earlier, most of the people who have been displaced in Austin are from the East Austin communities, which are predominantly Black and Latino communities. But most of the properties that the city owns are not in East Austin. Most appear to be in Northwest Austin and District 6, although some others are in Districts 1, 3, and 4, which account for, and 2, which account for East Austin. But this is because the land there is expensive, right? That's why families have been displaced and gentrified in those parts of the city, because they are where some of the most valuable land is outside of downtown. So it would be difficult for the city through this program to send displaced families back to where perhaps they would have been living, where their communities were, but it does send them to bring them back into the city rather.
Well, it's a relief, certainly for the people who qualify and actually make it into one of those properties. It's a really good thing, right?
Yeah, it seems so. Again, this is the first time the city has attempted something like this. So we'll see how well it goes. You know, there's always the chance that some problem the staff didn't anticipate arises or some other trouble happens, but hopefully it'll run smoothly. And if not, the wrinkles will get ironed out before the next properties go through the lottery process.
Well, on a different note, we've been talking in some of our previous shows about unionization. Last week, we talked about the EMS union and its negotiations with the city. There was a pretty wide gap between what the EMS union was seeking and what the city was offering. But I noticed this week you've got a story about Integral Care. Tell us a little about that.
Yeah, so Integral Care is a governmental entity. They provide mostly mental health care services, the largest provider of mental health care services in Travis County. And for the past year, their workforce has been trying to unionize. There's about 950 non-executive management personnel at Integral Care. They've been pretty close to unionizing. I reported at the end of March that following a meeting of Integral Care's Board of Trustees, it looked like, you know, unionization was all but certain, right? Just the board needed to approve this agreement between the union and agency executives, kind of ratifying the union more or less. But following a meeting that occurred April 14th, that is less certain. Basically, Integral Care's management proposed, you know, a series of changes to this agreement that would establish the union, outline its powers and how it would operate and interact with management, that organizers and employees at Integral Care say would really undermine the union's power and purpose. You know, one employee told me, if these changes go through, I don't even see the purpose of having a union, right? That's how extensive the changes are that management has proposed. So it's really troubling development in the story that looked to be heading in a positive direction for the workforce. It's kind of unclear where things are going from here. The board is expected to vote on the agreement later this week on Thursday, April 28th. I don't know yet if that's going to happen for sure as we're recording this, or whether or not employees and organizers even want the vote to proceed, given the level of change that management is seeking to make. But it's a story that I'll continue to follow and will update as needed.
Well, we'll certainly be watching for that. I know that you're on a break with the city council, so I'll let you get back to that. But we sure do appreciate your fitting us in here today and updating us on these two stories. So
yeah,
many thanks.
Definitely. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
That's all from us this evening. Stay safe, everyone. Stay tuned for Co-op's local music mix next on the HD3 channel and on co-op.org.
Thank you.